0818 715 815. Hello, good afternoon, you're welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungoyne here. You can call us on 0818 715 815, WhatsApp 087 184 3709, email joe@rte.ie or text us on 51551. Tom McGawley, where was your grandfather, the man you regard as your hero, in June 1922?
Well, Colm, dig with, Colm Tartu. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Grimina,
My granddad, Tom McGawley, and my namesake, he was in June 1922, he was on, from the 28th of June, he was on O'Donovan Rosser Bridge. And he was there for a very specific reason, because he was part of the army deployment that was tasked with flushing out the anti-treaty contingent led by Rory O'Connor. It also included the likes of Sean Lamass, Ernie O'Malley, Joe Griffin, etc. So granddad was, he was a gunner on the bridge, and he was there for a number of days taking pot shots at another gunner who would have been a former comrade up until months, literally just a matter of months beforehand, and they were taking pot shots at each other. And the interesting thing, Colm, about the story is that obviously my granddad lived to tell the tale, but he always wondered what happened to the to his opponent on the other side. And my Auntie Mary, Lord of Mercy on her, she was, for many years, was the she was the PA to a series and succession of managing directors at Waterford Crystal, or Waterford Glass. And at the time, shortly after she took up the role, the managing director at the time was a man called Noel Griffin. And he asked Mary if she would invite her parents, my granny and granddad, to a social event that was being organised by the company, because his parents, Joe and Maureen, would be in attendance, and he thought it'd be nice for them to have the company of people of a similar age. So they were delighted, you know, got them out of Wicklow for the night, and they spent the company at the table with Mr. and Mrs. Griffin. And I think one of the marks of that generation. Oh, so,
sorry,
that,
what year would this have been when they attended
this would have been over 40 years later. This is in the late 1960s. So almost 50 years had passed. And so they went along, and I think, as was the practice of members of that generation, they became fairly adept at sussing out what side of the treaty divide you were on by asking polite and subtle but probing questions to establish the bona fides of the other in relation to the treaty and the Civil War. And my Auntie Mary, she used to tell the story that she looked over at one point just to check and see how they were getting on. And my grandfather, who was a very reserved man by nature, he was a man of his generation, he was dabbing his eyes with a handkerchief. So she went over to my grandmother and said, what's the matter with Dad? And Granny told her that my grandfather and Mr. Griffin had established through the conversation that they had been on opposing sides in the Civil War. Actually, Joe Griffin had been the Director of Intelligence in the anti-treaty IRA, and he was with Harry Boland the day that Harry Boland was arrested, and the day he died in Malahide. And then they found themselves in the same part of Dublin in June 22. There was a 22-year-old Joe Griffin and a 20-year-old Tom McGawley in the army, and they'd taken up their respective positions, and Griffin was the gunner and the machine gun, or the gunner's nest on top of the forecourts, and my granddad Tom McGawley was trying to shoot him from the bridge, and they exchanged fire over the course of the event. And there they were 40 years later, Colm, in different circumstances, where they're finally meet in person and for the first time look each other in the eye and see a fellow human being returning their gaze. And my granddad said at the time, it wasn't a good job, we were both lousy shots, you know. So that in itself tells its own story, you know, that they found a huge common ground. And I think it's like the old maxim that we have a lot more in common, far more in common than separates us as people.
And so, do you know how they established where one another were on the day? Because you say it began with a kind of a gentle probing, and obviously nobody knows what way that kind of a conversation is going to turn in the climate of the times. I suppose even history as it was taught in schools came to a dead stop in 1916 precisely just to avoid this very subject. So how did they get on it, do you know?
I can only surmise, Cullum, and I can only surmise by what I know of my grandfather, and he was a man of absolute integrity, as was, I believe, Joe Griffin. And just on an aside, I think it's important, looking back with a sense of maturity and perspective, that that I think every single one of the protagonists in the Civil War, all the men and women, that they believed that they were acting in good faith, and that they were acting in the best interests of Ireland and Irish freedom. You know, obviously, they disagreed fundamentally and regrettably, often in the most callous and brutal of ways. But their motives, to me, were at least, and to them, were well-meaning and heartfelt. And I think, in the fullness of time as well, and also the fact that, you know, my granddad would have known of Joe Griffin through my Auntie Mary, and she has a huge amount of respect for him. And Joe Griffin, with, I think it was Joe McGrath, had set up the sweepstakes. So he was somebody who would have been in the public eye, or he would have been certainly on the radar. And I think granddad being granddad, and obviously Joe Griffin being Joe Griffin, they would have looked beyond the enmity of...
And the reason we're talking to you today, Tom, is, you know, it's 2 years from, we're 2 years away from the centenary of the end of that civil war. I mean, those young men at that time weren't to know how long this would stretch on for, or indeed how many of them would be fortunate enough to survive it, or what the effects on the country might be. And indeed, if anybody else wants to share similar stories or any family story about it, you can get us on joe@rt.ie by email, or text us on 51551, WhatsApp us 0871843709, or of course call us on 0818715815. But your grandfather, Tom McGauley, your namesake, maybe his skills that he developed over a career in policing helped him to ask things in the right way in order to get the information he wanted.
That's a very good point, Colm. And I know anyone from Wicklow town of a certain vintage listening to this will remember him as Gard McGauley. And, you know, I think people who have spoken to from the generations, he retired in 1966, but they speak of him as being a very fair-minded and a very decent individual, you know. I think he made the grand total. I remember when the Garda Museum opened, I went in to look at his files, and he made the grand total of one arrest, you know, in his entire career as a guard. But yeah, he was part of the original
light touch guard. Regulation, I think they call it.
Light touch regulation. That's it. Exactly. Exactly. I think what people would now call the restorative approach, you know, rather than the retributive approach. You know, you get to know people, build relationships, and it's community policing, and that's what he believed in.
And he joined the guards when? Obviously very early in the establishment of the force.
He was born in 1902. He's from Kilkenny originally and raised in Blackrock, and he joined the IRA in 1919 as a 17-year-old, and he was part of the 4th Battalion of the South Dublin Brigade. And then when the Civic Guard replaced the RIC in 1922, he joined it. And they were seconded to the National Army when the Civil War when the clouds of war were forming for what would become the Civil War.
Right. And so he hadn't been. I mean, he was operating probably with a rifle in Dublin during the War of Independence. So the fact that he found himself manning heavy artillery at the forecourts, was it in charge of a field gun? He or operating a field gun or a rifle? He was.
I don't know the answer to that, right, Colm. I'd only be speculating, so I don't know. And he died in 1987, so he's no longer here to fill in the details on that. But what I do know was that he was part of the, like, last year there was a centenary of the ceremonial handover of Dublin Castle from the RIC, the British, to the Irish state, and the guards were part of that as well. And we've found a photograph with Grandad front and centre, marching in through the iconic gate there on Castle Street.
Had you ever seen it before?
I hadn't, and it was published in a lot of the papers, and we went through it, and we said, well, it's unmistakably him, you know, and he was a very tall man for his, and quite a striking looking individual. Apparently, he made a lot of hearts flutter in Wicklow when he was stationed there, you know. But my granny she kind of dibs them, you know, said, I'm going to marry him. But so he was in the guards then from 22 to 66, and most of his career would have been stationed in Wicklow Garda Station. He had a stint in Drogheda in the 1930s as well, and he was He was with the LDF then during World War II, during the emergency as well, you know.
You mentioned there that Joe Griffin. So Joe Griffin would have been the father of the managing director of Waterford Glass, Noel Griffin, at the time. So his father, Joe Griffin, was the man who was on top of the building in the forecourts. Now, what research have you done about him? Because he was involved in the anti-treaty IRA's intelligence operation.
He was. I know for a fact that he was part of, with Rory O'Connor and others, he was part of, and he would have been a higher ranking member of the IRA than my grandfather, even though he was only 2 years older. And then when the split over the treaty occurred, obviously he had taken his side on the opposite side to my granddad, and for his own reasons. And then he was a confidant and a associate of Harry Boland. We know for a fact that he was in the forecourts. And one of the ironies of history and of life in Ireland, Colm, as you well know, it's a small country, is that Joe Griffin's granddaughter Maureen, she's named after Joe Griffin's wife Maureen, and his grandson Joe. I was in school with Joe Griffin, and I didn't realise the significance of it.
So at that stage, when you were in secondary school, you hadn't heard the story of the meeting of the two adversaries?
No idea about it. That only came out probably when I was about 19 or 20, just in passing, my Auntie Mary was talking. And she was a mine of information about the family history, you know, and a kind of encyclopedic memory. And so I told Maureen about it, and we were kind of tickled about it, because for years, being in school with Joe. Sadly, Joe Griffin is no longer with us now, Joe Griffin Jr. But I was oblivious to the fact that our grandfathers had that their paths had crossed, and our namesakes had crossed. At that stage, it would have been 60 plus years before. Like, that was going back to the 80s for when I was in school. But again, it shows, I think, the futility is maybe the wrong word, but the tragedy of civil war, you know, that had one of those shots landed, I wouldn't be on the line today, or we wouldn't have been friends with Joe and Maureen Griffin years later, you know. So events would have taken a very, very different turn for either family.
And that's one of the Battle of the Forecourts and the Siege of the Forecourts is one of the iconic events. And, there was obviously people killed on both sides. But one of the great national tragedies of it, I suppose, is the burning of that many documents. But your grandfather, not only was he at that, but he was at another iconic event of the Civil War after the ambush of Michael Collins.
Yes. Yeah, he was indeed. And I think, like so many others of his generation, and on both sides, it has to be said, he was deeply affected by the death of Collins. And for the funeral of Collins, in August 22, Granda was part of the original Garda band. I go to a lot of sporting events, and the Garda band would be there. And I often think my Granda was the first part of the first. He played the snare drum, you know. And so it was the Civic Guard band then. And they formed the military cortege. There were 17 bands in that cortege. And I think that the cortege went on for 5 or 6 miles, depending on which source you believe. But it was such a big cortege. They placed the guards at the back, you know. So he used to tell a story that by the time they were getting to the junction of Blessington Street, they were meeting, the first band were already making their way back into the city, you know. So it wasn't exactly, he wasn't there for the graveside oration or anything like that, but he felt very proud of that. But I think, again,
did he stay in the Garda band? Because my impression of the Garda band was always like that it was something like the army band where people, that's their job in the guards, but it's not. Did he balance membership of the Garda band with Garda duties, did he?
No, he didn't. No, duties took precedence fairly shortly afterwards. But he was a founding member of the St. Patrick's Pipe Band in Wicklow. He was an absolute devotee of pipe bands, and he's passed that down through the generations as well. You know, I remember one of the highlights of the, apart from the All Ireland hurling final, he's an avid Kilkenny fan, was the Edinburgh tattoo as well with the pipe bands. You know, he'd always have the TV blaring for that. But no, he didn't. I think at that stage he joined the guards to police, and that's what he took great pride in, you know.
And your Auntie Mary, she was a mine of information. So she obviously had conversations with your grandfather. I mean, did you ever personally speak to him about his experience, or did he talk about his experience during the of the War of Independence or Civil War?
Yeah, it's a good question, Colin. And I tried to, but what I found with Grandad, he had a great devotion to Collins, and he had great affection for his former comrades. But he would have kind of stock answers like, "Ah, but you're, what do you need to know that for? You know, or that's best left in the past." You know, there were a couple of things, though, a couple of kind of giveaways over the years. Like, I remember him saying to me, giving me a bit of advice. He said, "Never trust a teetotaler." Now, apologies to any teetotalers who are listening, but he said, "Never trust a teetotaler because they're fundamentalists. They've too much to prove." You know, so they're all or nothing. And I think that was certainly born out of his experience of that kind of rancorous time where...
He had a kind of a suspicion of dogmatic ideology, is that what you mean?
He did, yeah, exactly. I think for Grandad, if you... And I know I'm putting words in his mouth now, but the middle path, there's always a middle path that can be found, you know? So, you know, we shouldn't rush to the barricade on either end of the spectrum without trying to find other ways.
All right.
You know, so I think that there was a wistfulness about him when it came to that period of Irish history, and that lived with him, as it did with his entire generation, and particularly those who had seen action.
Tom, stay with us because Bernadette O'Connor is on the line.
Will do, Colm. Yeah.
Bernadette, you're a grandniece of Liam Lynch. He was also a man who, even though it's not often portrayed as such in history now, he was somebody who also tried to find a middle path.
Yes, how are you, Colm? And very interesting there listening to Tom. How are you? He did try to find the middle ground, but when it came to it, I suppose after the truce was signed and the treaty was signed, he decided to go into conflict, you know, and that's the way he dealt. Himself and Michael Connors, they would have been on very good terms during the War of Independence and all of his other colleagues. But I think after the bombing of the four courts and that, there was no going back. He would have witnessed after the 1916 rising in Fermoy. He was working as an apprentice in a hardware shop there, and he would have witnessed the Kent brothers following the 1916 rising, being marched across the bridge in Fermoy by the British Army. And I think that was the catalyst for him then, for the future, that, you know, it was going into armed conflict, really. He had a good time for Michael Collins and the political side of it as well, but he decided to go the other route.
Well, there was firm foundations within your family, wasn't there? I mean, Liam Lynch's biographies also say there was a history of land activism and even Fenianism within the family.
That's right. His father, Jeremiah, was a member of the Fenians, and his mother, Mary, was secretary of the local Ballylanders Land League. So, and he was very influenced by his godmother, who Hannah Cleary, who was... a daughter of William Condon, who was also very involved in the Fenians, and had ridden to Kilmallock to join, you know, a group there who thought they were going to Dublin for the rising. So, yeah, it was in his background and back further as well. So I think following that event in Fermoy, then he, with the Kent brothers, he joined the Volunteers and... climbed the ranks fairly quickly. He also joined the Gaelic League, and I think his whole attitude would have changed, and he decided then to dedicate his life to freedom.
His brother, your grandfather? What was his involvement?
Yeah. He had two other brothers involved in the conflict. So there was John, who was my grandfather, my mother's dad, and he had a brother, James, as well. So both of them were very involved in the conflict, and they were actually interred in Newbridge and Curra over the years. And so when Liam was tragically shot on the Knockmill Downs, they weren't allowed out to the funeral, because they would not swear the oath of allegiance. So his mother really...
That was a condition of attending the funeral, was it? In order to get out of internment in the Curragh.
Yeah.
They had to swear the oath of allegiance.
They had to swear the oath. So the two of them were missing, and he had two other brothers then, Martin and Tom, who were both in religious orders. They were a very religious family, and a family of very high principles. As you will see with a lot of the volunteers or, you know, comrades,
right.
They have great faith. That's the one thing I would always have picked up from letters and reading and just general observations, family. Yeah.
Bernadette, just hold it there a second because we just have to take a short break. We'll be back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we have Bernadette O'Connor on the line, who is the great-grandniece of Liam Lynch, the former anti-treaty IRA chief of staff who was shot dead in the Knockmeldown Mountains on the 10th of April 1923. She's relating her experience of a civil war narrative within the family. But do get in touch if you have one in your own family. joe@rte.ie, text us on 51551 or WhatsApp us on 0871843709, as you heard just before we came back, 0818715815, if you want to ring us in. Bernadette, just to go back to your own grandfather, after being how was he released from internment, and what kind of a man was he based on his experiences in this period?
Okay, I'm a grandniece of Liam Lynch's, not a great-grandniece. Yeah.
I beg your pardon, a grandniece.
Oh, okay, no problem.
Sorry, a grandniece. So, but your own grandfather, who is your own grandfather, after he came out, was he still around for you to talk to when you were growing up?
Well, I would have been very young because passed away in 1966. But I do remember as a child... there was a commemoration in Fermoy every September, organised by the National Liam Lynch Commemoration Committee, who are based in Fermoy. And my grandfather would arrive on the morning of that commemoration, and he'd have his own laurel wreath, you know, the traditional Republican wreaths, ready and very proud in his suit and medals. And, yeah, he did speak about it, but, I mean, I would have been too young. I was only 5 or 6 at that stage. But following the commemorations, then we would all come back to our house in Fermoy, our family house, with other members of the Lynch family, cousins and that, and there would be a lot of discussion at the table about who gave the oration, you know, the politics of the day, and every detail would have been analysed. So I suppose we listened and learned to a lot of our own history lessons through those commemoration days, and of course through the great orators that delivered the orations at the commemorations themselves. So we grew up. It was part of our lives from a very young age, all our cousins as well. And I suppose later on then history. I would really favoured history when I attended secondary school and started it for my Leaving Cert. But unfortunately, a lot of the events after 1916 weren't taught. So I'm now making up for last time, you know. So my grandfather was a very jovial, happy man. Well, that's the impression he gave, but very proud. And he would have kept in contact with a lot of his comrades and a lot of Liam Lynch's comrades as well that would have been interred and would have fought in the Civil War. There's three commemorations, I think, since 1935. There's another commemoration held in Newcastle in County Tipperary, very near at the foot of Knockmeldowns where Liam was shot. And... so that's held every year in April, then September, the Fermoy one. And there's also a commemoration held in Anglesborough each September where Liam Lynch would have been born there. So Yeah, there was a lot of people who turned up every year for decades to honour his memory.
And Tom, you know? Tom, you maintained an interest in history as well, to this day,
indeed. I did call him, that's right, yeah. And it's fascinating listening to Bernadette speak there, because I would have nothing but the highest regard for Liam Lynch and for many of the others. You know, like, obviously I'm aware that the lens through which I was raised, you know, and I think that's one of the regrettable, apart from the carnage and the brutality of the Civil War, but it in a way tarnished, if that's the right word, generations that came later.
You said your grandfather had a great devotion to Michael Collins. So I suppose by extension, yeah, what was his view of Eamon de Valera?
His view of Eamon de Valera wouldn't have been as benign, put it that way. And you know, and I think that certainly for me in my early years would have coloured my view of de Valera. There's a story about that my dad tells about the 50th anniversary of the Rising in 1966 and the ceremony that was taking place. And my father said it was the only time he ever heard my granddad curse, because de Valera, God love him, his eyesight was failing at that point, and he was inspecting the Guard of Honour down towards O'Connell Bridge, and not realising that the Guard of Honour had finished, he was still nodding his approval into thin air. And apparently Grandad said, keep walking all the way into the Liffey, you're blind, and you can fill in the rest yourself. But that would have been an uncharacteristic kind of comment and you know, kind of maybe a verbal slip by him. But I think for me, and listening to Bernadette as well, it's important that I think finally we've come to a place of maturity where we can hold the opposing narratives in a space of respect and perspective. I suppose really it's where we can disagree agreeably, you know. Yeah. And I have nothing but the highest respect for everybody, every man and woman who risked their own personal safety during the War of Independence and then in the Civil War, because to go back to a point I made earlier on, I don't believe that any of them believed that they were doing anything but their best for Ireland and for Irish freedom.
Exactly.
They had different ways of expressing it, you know, and I think Liam Lynch, like many on the anti-treaty side, was a man of deep principle, and his beliefs were sincerely held, and a man of integrity. And, you know, I'm a secondary school teacher these days, Bernadette, and we remembered your great uncle's anniversary recently, his centenary anniversary as well, as I do with, yeah, and I think it's important. And one of the things I've observed in 25 years teaching now is that I think finally the generation today they've moved beyond the shadow of the Civil War. And because when I started teaching, I'd always ask the question, when we got to the treaty and the treaty debates, the vote in the Dáil, the Civil War, the June election of 1922, would any of you be aware of your family connection to this? And the overwhelming majority were. Nowadays, the overwhelming majority don't know what side their family was on. And so when you ask them the question, which I always do because it's interesting, how would you have voted in the treaty? They're not voting with any, I suppose, that they haven't been guided by any narrative. Now, that might be regrettable in the sense that they've lost touch with their family connection, but I think they're coming at our history in maybe a more objective way than certainly would have been the case for me.
I'm struck just to, Tom, one of the other kind of reconciliations that happened within the fringes of your own family. You mentioned Joe Griffin, who along with Joe McGrath founded Waterford Glass. But even in the jobs they were in, Joe Griffin was the anti-treaty intelligence head, and Joe McGrath headed up the notorious Oriel House, which was responsible for many extrajudicial executions, particularly around the Dublin area, and would later go on to found the Irish Sweepstakes, which I think, as a recent Scannell documentary said, was pushing tickets in the United States through gun-running networks that McGrath had established through his IRB days.
Right. I didn't realise that, Colin.
So, did you ever buy a sweepstakes ticket?
A sweepstakes? Am I that old? I have prize bonds. Does that count?
Bernadette, did you ever buy a sweepstakes ticket in your day?
Yes. Yeah. Going back, and my parents bought them as well. And actually, just one point there. Liam Lynch had a romantic liaison with a lady called Bridie Keys from Mitchestown. But, you know, they called an end to it when he decided to dedicate his whole life to Irish freedom for a while anyway. But she actually left Mitchestown and went working in the sweepstakes in Dublin. So there seemed to be a connection. I've heard of other connections as well with republicanism and the sweepstakes organisation.
Well, as I say, the Scannell documentary is a fascinating one, if you can find it to watch back on it. Joe McGrath and the role he played in it. It's a fascinating use that there was, that they never questioned, the tickets were never supposed to be sold outside of Ireland, but they never questioned the fact that the revenue that came in from the sweepstakes seemed to exceed any possible sales in Ireland. So there was a kind of an ask no questions policy about the revenue they gathered. Bernadette, what about how politics was treated in your family in the aftermath of the Civil War? You said your own grandfather was a fairly jovial man, but on the subject of politics, was there any rancor applied to politics later after the Civil War? Did they have a very definite side of things throughout the rest of their lives?
That generation would have, and definitely, I suppose, true to be more than the Fianna Fáil side, you know, because of the anti-treaty and that. And most of my relations throughout the generations. But definitely, I would say now that, you know, we're custodians, the way we look at it now is we're custodians of a lot of historical accounts, papers, memorabilia associated with this period of Irish history. And the way we're looking at it now is outside of politics, that it's, I suppose, to work with the historians and the academics to talk about it. And, you know, we are healing as a country. As Tom said there, things have moved on and it's not our war, but we'll never forget it. We'll always have to remember those very brave people that gave up so much of their lives for us. But so I suppose men and women from all communities and social backgrounds died for their ideas because they felt the political system of the day failed them. But I suppose in the future, you know, we will remember.
I think Tom is under pressure to go and educate the next generation. Okay. But before you go, Tom, we have Anna on the line, whose grandfather was also at the Four Courts and also operating a gun. And Anna got wounded for his troubles, was it?
Yeah, he got wounded in the leg.
So how did he find himself there?
Well, he was in the army. He was with Michael Collins in the army. He was in the Ordnance Corps. He ended up as a commandant in the Ordnance Corps up in Clancy Barracks.
And how did he, I mean, I suppose being an artillery operator is a skill that may not have been acquired during the War of Independence. So how did he find himself in charge of heavy artillery at the Four Courts?
Well, he joined the British Army or the British Navy when he was 19. And he was in charge of a lot of the guns then eventually in the Navy. And then he was invalided out of the Navy and came back here. And that's how he got involved.
And what decided him on joining? Did he get involved during the War of Independence or did he join during the Civil War?
I think he got involved before the Civil War, doing the guns. But I think mainly it was for a job.
And where was he from?
Oh, he was from down around Sandymount they ended up in, but they lived all over Dublin.
And he spent the rest of his career in the army after the Civil War, did he?
Oh, yeah, he spent the rest of his career as a commandant up in Clancy Barracks.
And do you remember him?
Oh, yeah, I remember him well, yeah.
Were you encouraged to ask him about how he got a bullet in the leg?
Well, he used to tell us now and then. He very rarely spoke about things, but now and then he would make different remarks, and he always said he admired greatly the man that fired on him from the Four Courts because he was a great shot and he hit him in the leg.
And he doesn't recall at all where the shot came from, does he?
No. I suppose with all the melee that was going on, you wouldn't be looking, you know.
And did he ever pull up the trouser leg and show you the scar? as kids?
Now and then when we were little kids, he would, as a joke, you know. But that's it. He was in charge of the guns after the fire on the forecourt. And one of the guns, I believe, has been restored and is going to be down in the Curra in the museum.
Yeah, there's a museum there that's open, I think, for most of the week, and it's free entry. They have a collection.
It's an excellent museum, and I don't think it gets enough publicity.
Well, they have a lot of vehicles that used to be up in the cavalry sheds in the Curra that have now been restored, and they're down on display in the museum in the Curra. They have exhibitions going to all of Ireland's peacekeeping operations overseas as well, and they have stuff from this period as well. So it is, you're right on it. It's a fascinating exhibition down there.
I've been down there because he also built the gun carriage for Michael Collins. He's on the left-hand side of it.
So he was there on the day of the funeral, is it, the gun carriage?
He was, yeah. He was in charge of one of the garrisons, I think, one of the men for the funeral. And he's sitting on the left-hand side of the gun carriage.
Right, so your grandfather, who was at the forecourts operating guns, and Tom O'Gawley's grandfather, who was there, who didn't get shot on the day, were in close proximity, not only on the day of the forecourt siege, but also at Michael Collins's funeral.
On the day of the funeral, yeah. That their granddad was on the gun carriage on the left-hand side of it.
And you,
Hi, Anna. My granddad would have been a couple of hundred metres behind your granddad and the cortege, at least, but
probably
cheek to jowl during the forecourts operation itself, you know.
He was on the gun carriage itself.
Colin, before I go, and I'm sorry, but I have to go to class in a minute, but just about the, I suppose, in the grand scheme of things, the school that I teach in, Eamon de Valera actually taught in the school for 1 year, from 1910 to 1911, and Eamon O'Queeve, he was then a minister, visited the school and spoke very well. And I asked him about what does he consider de Valera's greatest political achievement. And he was very mature and magnanimous in his reply. He said that he believed that Dev's greatest achievement was one that he shares with W.T. Cosgrave, and it was the peaceful transition of power in 1932. Because elsewhere in Europe, European states were in kind of mindless paroxysms, were throwing themselves into the arms of autocracy and despotism. And, you know, I think that was a very telling reflection by Eamon O'Queeve at the time.
Indeed.
Because it showed that Irish democracy was robust and well-established.
Anyone who went to Leinster House on that day in 1932 when power was handed over with a pistol in their pocket never ultimately produced it, which was,
I suppose, to
the testament of the democracy that had been established. Tom, just before you go, we'll let you know that we have Rory Brennan on another line, who is a grandson of Joe Griffin, who was at that occasion.
Ah, there you go. So Rory would be an Arklow man. I think the Brennans were an Arklow.
We're going to hear from you, Rory, shortly after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Email us on joe@rt.ie or text us on 51551. We're 2 days away from the end of the centenary of the end of the Civil War, a conflict that many say didn't end, at least in Irish political circles, and defined voting for several generations afterwards, possibly only coming to an end in the formal coalition of the recent government. But the silence around this in families and the fact that the Civil War wasn't talked about openly or indeed taught officially in school history over many number of years just shows the depths to which this divided people and families indeed, and beyond. Anna, just, we were speaking to you before the break. Your grandfather was in charge of the guns at the siege of the forecourts in June 1922. He was wounded there and stayed in the army and ultimately retired as a commandant.
He was a commandant, yeah.
And how did he die, Anne? What age was he when he ultimately died?
Oh, he just got sick, like he was in his 70s when he died. I think he got a clot or something like that.
He didn't relate it to the wound he got at the forecourt.
No. Nothing to do with the wound.
Yeah, no. What was his name to anybody who might have known him?
Sorry, he was known as Johnny Doyle. He was a captain when he was at the forecourt, and then he became a commandant later on.
And you mentioned there the museum in the Curra, and you made a donation to the museum, did you?
The army in those days, later on, they had a beautiful dress uniform. It was a lovely cloak with a red satin lining and boots with spurs on it and a sword. Granda had his one. We had it at home for, just until before COVID. And then Mammy decided what we were going to do with it. And we gave it down to the Curragh. So it's gone down to the Curragh.
So this original dress uniform from when it was introduced at the beginning of the Army's life as the Army of the State is now on display for all to see down in the Curragh.
Yes, it should be. I haven't been down because of COVID. I hope to go down probably in the summer. But it should be on display. There's a beautiful sword with it and a lovely cloak and everything else. It was a beautiful uniform.
All right. Well, it was a generous gesture, certainly, by your family to put that on display. I'm sure there aren't many of those uniforms, indeed, if any, around.
There was three of them made for the Ordnance Corps. My grandfather had one. His brother, who was another commandant, he had the second one, but it got destroyed, and they don't know where the third one went. So Granda's one was the only one that was intact and all there, and that's gone down to the Curragh.
And Rory Brennan, your granddad, Joe Griffin, was on the roof of the forecourts manning a gun. He may have been the man who shot Anna's grandfather.
Could have been.
I hope not.
Well, he only shot him in the leg. He only got him in the leg.
I don't think he was that good of a shot.
My grandfather said whoever shot him, he admired the man that shot him. He had a wonderful shot.
Well, you don't think that fits the bill in your you don't think that fits the bill in the case of your granddad. So you were listening to Tom McGauley there, Rory.
Before, absolutely, Tom. Yeah.
But before you called in, tell us about your granddad.
So yeah, my granddad basically.
Sorry, Anna, I was just asking Rory about his granddad, Joe Griffin, that was on the roof of the forecourts. Yeah. I mean, how did you come to know about his story growing up, Rory?
Just through all my my mum and aunties and uncles, they came from a very big family. Joseph Griffin, he was a Kerry man, so he was born in 1900. And he went into the civil service at the age of, he was actually very young, he passed his exams exceptionally young, at 17 years of age. During that time, he joined the local battalion in Tralee of the Irish Volunteers. And shortly after that, he was asked by his boss, the government then, the Oath of Allegiance to the Crown, and he refused that, and then he left. And he then got really, he joined the Dublin Brigade and was instrumental in a number of successful, they burnt the British income tax records in Tralee Custom House. And he evolved. And he was a very sincere man. And what Tom said earlier in terms of, he never, to Mom always said, and my aunties and uncles, he died in 1967, and I was only one. And he was really sentimental. He never spoke about the past. He just hated
never.
The fact that it was just that he hated the fact that brother and brother were put against each other. And he kept a very low profile. He was with Harry Boland. So Harry Boland was the acting brigade IRA quartermaster in 1922. And himself and Harry were over in Skerries. They were hiding out, obviously. The pro-treaty people were after them, and they got raided. Somebody obviously ratted on them, and they got raided, and Harry Boland was shot dead, and Grandad was taken away and arrested. But he's a very smart man. He then became chief intelligence for the pro-treaty and the IRA then, and he was just so, years and years later, as Tom mentioned, he did actually meet his, I'm sure a number of people, but he met his, the person who was directly opposite him in terms of basically.
Right. So you said there, and I think it was a slip of the tongue, you said he was head of the pro-treaty intelligence, the IRA.
He was head of the anti-treaty.
Yeah. And he met Joe McGrath, who was the senior intelligence figure on the pro-treaty side and was involved in the criminal investigation division in the criminal investigation department out of Oriel House, which gained a fearsome reputation amongst I suppose, the country as a whole, but particularly amongst anti-treaty Republicans?
Yeah, and that part I'm not too sure of, so I'm not totally aware of that. But all I know, I suppose, in terms of he definitely didn't like discussing pro and anti-treaty situations because he was forced into a situation at the very start because of the treaty. And that left him, I suppose, throughout his life, basically, he was an incredibly successful man. He set up Waterford Glass, he set up the sugar company. So he was a great civil servant and a great businessman. But he always regretted the fact that the Irish people, not the English people, had to fight each other because of what Britain had put, you know, put us into this desperate situation. And that certainly was... And he had Sean Lamass as one of his best mates. He would have had a full gun salute funeral in 1967, where, you know, everyone who was strong in terms of church and politics was there, and business was there, and people obviously from the pro-treaty side who right. believed he was a
very
good gentleman.
I think Joe McGrath, who had been suspected of killing Sean Lamass's brother, Noel Lamass, which was another extrajudicial killing during the Civil War. They later became card partners. They played poker together. They were
big time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Joe McGrath then got involved in the sweepstakes, the Irish sweepstakes, and involved in there. So there was things settled, I suppose. But that's the way it was. I mean, at the end of the day, you're an Irish person, like, you know. But there was definitely regret for the fact that the British had put us into the situation where we have to fight brother and brother and friend and friend.
Do you think your own grandfather, I mean, I suppose the head of intelligence for the anti-treaty IRA would have involved not only gathering intelligence on the pro-treaty side, but it would have involved dealing with internal security, in other words, finding and eliminating informers. Would that maybe explain why your grandfather might have been reluctant to look backwards into the past?
Possibly, but I would have thought the very fact that he's in the same room with Harry Boland when he saw somebody come in and shoot Harry Boland would have left a scar in his, on his brain forever in terms of, like, you know. So I'd say Joe, obviously he's head of intelligence. He would have kept an exceptionally low profile, even for himself. He was twice put into jail, in Camanum jail.
How did he escape? If he was with Harry Boland when he was arrested, how did he manage to be at liberty at all?
He actually escaped a couple of times in different areas, but in that one, basically, he was caught, but then he did later escape, and he was in the forecourts, and he escaped that because they just got lucky. I suppose they knew the best routes out. They're smart men, and they were the main instigators of a lot of things. But
do you know of any of his escape stories?
I don't, but I certainly know that when he went in, when he was in Camanum jail, he signed himself off in Irish. So and they took a picture of him in Irish. But they, when he got arrested again, they couldn't add the two and two together because one was in Irish and one was in English.
So he gave his name in English the second time he was arrested.
And they didn't think he was any big wigger or anything, so he got away with it. So he was clever, like, you know, he always covered his trails.
So arrested the first time as Joseph O'Griffa and arrested the second time as Joe Griffin.
Oh, yeah, and he's a terribly intelligent man, like, you know, but I'd say terribly passionate as well about the country and the people and how, unfortunately, somebody was saying we had to, you know, sign an oath of allegiance to work in this country, which to him beggared belief, like, you know.
All right, but he was prepared to give his name in English, which was, I suppose, it proved
ultimately,
useful.
Yeah, he did, because he knew then they couldn't track him again.
Yeah, it proved useful at that point. I just want to ask you a couple of questions about who was the custodian of the, you know, your grandfather's stories within the family. We just have to take a short break before I do that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Rory Brennan, before we let you go, your grandfather was Joe Griffin, a man who was a gunner on the roof of the forecourts for the anti-treaty IRA, shooting down at the grandfather of Tom McGauley, who we heard from earlier. You said he didn't talk about the Civil War as the family were growing up. So Did he talk to anyone about it, or how does the family know any of his stories, or is this just something they had to read up about?
Good question. Obviously, Mom and the brothers and the rest of the family would have heard snippets over the years, but only the last couple of years did we find a guy called Des White, and he'd been commissioned by the Customs House Commemoration, which is www.customhousecommemoration.com, and within that, he had rang up a number of members of the family and asked, you know, just to clarify some information. And information we didn't even know, Mom didn't even know, and my uncle didn't even know half the stuff that was in it, because it was this guy, obviously, Des knows the stuff, and by golly, there's 8 pages of research and pictures and everything. So that to us was like, wow, okay. And particularly to the grandkids. So my own brothers, and oh my God, we got a vast amount of cousins, and all of us were so proud when we saw this 10-page document with pictures of everything. So that's a legacy living on, and a lot of my uncles would have, my mum's still alive, but a lot of my uncles would have died fairly young in their age, so I wasn't able to get much information about them. So Tom did mention that my uncle Joe, which he knew, he may have went to school with his son, but Joe would have passed on some stories, but it's this guy, Des White, really, I mean, obviously he's been paid by the government to do it, but the amount of information in that document on Customs House commemoration is just brilliant, and that, right, to us has just left a great legacy, like.
Right. Okay. Just final thought. The idea of a state, sure, apology for the likes of extrajudicial killings and the like for comrades of your grandfather has been, I think, ruled out at this point. But with 2 days to go, do you think the state should rethink it, and maybe that there is something worthwhile in the state apologising for the areas it acknowledges it stepped outside the law on, and people were killed, murdered, in fact?
Above my pay grade.
Okay. Bernard, what about you? What about you, Bernadette? Do you have any thoughts on that? Your granduncle, Liam Lynch, was killed in the Knockmile Downs. He was shot and was, I think, already dying by the time there was even an opportunity to arrest him. But for other comrades who were killed in other circumstances, do you believe it would be worthwhile, or it would help in any way for the state to apologise?
I do, yes. I think there should be some acknowledgement of the horrendous events that took place, especially on behalf of the government. And it would maybe, you know, help with the healing. I mean, I know we've moved on, it's 100 years later, but I do think it would be, yeah, it would be appreciated. And it would sort of put a lot of things to rest, because there were some horrendous tragedies, you know, that we all knew of. Just there, you were speaking about giving the names in Irish. My grandfather was known as John Lynch, but he was also known as Sean Lynchick. And that seemed to have been quite a regular occurrence. And after one of the ambushes that Liam Lynch was involved with in September in Fermoy, at the Wesleyan Church, he was arrested soon afterwards, but gave his name in English or in Irish as well, so he wasn't, right, recognised. So that seems to have been a countrywide tactic,
all right,
at the time.
Okay, my thanks, yeah, to Bernadette O'Connor and Rory Brennan. We've been talking about the sound of gunfire at the forecourts, but what about this sound? Well, if you don't know what that sound is, it's a car indicator. And Tracy, not enough of that sound as far as you're concerned.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. And look at this, all probably sounds terrible trivial after your last discussion, but I live down in Dingle. And do you know what? I'd say like 3 out of every 4 people now don't indicate.
Just not bothered.
And Noel and I travel to Dublin to visit our daughter and our grandson. And we go on the motorway and people just hop from lane to lane and don't indicate. And like, look, I'm kind of I'm an anxious person. I was in an accident a couple of years ago, and I've been awful anxious on the road ever since. And, you know, this is another anxiety. You're looking at a car in front of you coming to turns, wondering, are they going to turn right or left? So you're anticipating that they might. And then they don't even indicate, and they do. Do you know what I mean? It's just... And, you know, I went to Mayo there a couple of weeks ago, and the same thing. And there's people from all over the world doing it, because we have visitors here the whole time. So there's people from Holland doing it, and England, and
people from all over the world. They're coming to Ireland to drive without indication. We're the non-indication driving capital of the world, are we?
Absolutely. Well, Well, I don't know. My sister said it's kind of getting bad in London too. But I don't know. Has the RSA said that we don't need to indicate anymore, and is it not in the rule book? Look, at Colm, it took me 8 times to get my test. And a few times I got marks for not indicating because I was changing lanes. You know what I mean?
Right.
I know that it's in the rule book, but I just wonder what's going on.
I know, but you're one of the best kind of for people who are former offenders. You now are coming at it with the zeal of a convert. You are now a fundamentalist indicator, having lapsed in the past. Where is it worst? Do you find it worse on a multi-lane motorway where you don't know where it's coming from?
It's terrible on the motorway, but it's just terrible here in town too. Like, nobody indicates at the roundabouts. They don't indicate if they're turning left or right. You know, they just don't do it anymore. The girl I was talking to this morning, now, God love her, hadn't noticed it, but she said, I'm probably going to notice it the whole time now.
It is bad on roundabouts, isn't it? People, you know, you don't know whether you can come on.
Not just roundabouts. Look at motorways as well, when people are jumping in and out of lanes, you know. I don't know.
Who's the worst offender, Anne? What kind of vehicles do you look at with the most trepidation?
Oh, listen, it's nearly every car, I tell you. Like, it really is nearly every car. I'd say 3 out of 4 people don't bother their Barney indicating anymore. And look, it's a common courtesy. It's a kindness to let the people who are coming behind you know that you're turning right or left. You know, it's just a common kindness.
And was it a factor? You mentioned you were in an accident there.
Was it a factor in the accident? No, God love, a poor woman came through a red light and hit the side of me. No, that wasn't... That had nothing to do with indication.
Right,
no,
but you mentioned courtesy there. We have developed, and I think this is only a habit in Ireland, where somebody pulls over into the hard shoulder to let someone else pass. The person that overtakes them using the single-lane road will hit the hazards in front to say thank you.
Yeah, I know. Oh, now, not everybody says thank you, because I often pull in for people and I don't get any thank you. But, you know, people do say thank you, and I love that. I do that the whole time as well, you know, if anyone does that for me on the road. Look, I don't know, it's something just to do with indication, and I really, really don't know why. Like,
right, and what's the worst instance of it that you can recall? Is there any particular standout moment of bad indication?
No, I tell you, no, because I'm giving people a wide berth now. Noel, my husband, do you know, he'd say to me, Anne, pull right back. And I do pull right back, and that's it. You know, I'm not going to be in a situation where it's going to cause me trouble. But you really have to watch it. Like, you really have to watch. No,
all right. Women or men, Anne?
God, everybody. Oh, gosh, no. It's
gender neutral, is it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And young people and old, do you know?
Right. Even the young drivers who have to do the theory test.
I know. And they're not long after. Some of them even still have an N on their car, I can tell you.
Right.
And they're not
for non-indication.
Yes. You know, the N is is the novice thing that they have after they've passed, and by God, like, they're not long past, and they're still doing it. I don't know what.
You'd relegate them back to an L, would you?
Some of them. Look at my grandson. He'd say that to me sometimes. You know, he'd say, "Gosh, you know," and they don't even have an L on their car.
So at this stage, he'd be afraid not to indicate, presumably.
You know, he's
stage.
17. Like, he's going to start learning how to drive now. The crater, so you know.
Right.
He'll know from me. Make sure you indicate.
Well, you'd hope he doesn't forget anything else. He'd be so hard concentrating on the indication.
Not at all. He'll hopefully pass first shot at it. He won't have to do it 8 times like he's done it.
You're living in Dingle at the moment, so where's the busiest roundabout around Dingle where this is particularly evident?
Oh, I suppose the busiest roundabout is down by Mourne's Garage. It would bring you, you know, you'd come by the Garda station in Dingle and Flaherty's pub, and there's that roundabout that it just takes you out of the town by Mourne's Garage. And that would be the one, I'd say, that would be the worst.
Right.
But no, I mean, it's just, I mean, every crossroads you come to, do you know what I mean? The car in front of you, if it's turning, it won't let you know, and off it goes. And that's just...
Well, the other habit of good manners in Ireland, rightly or wrongly, is people slowing down to let somebody pull out onto a road, but they're less likely to do it if they can't tell what direction the person is going to go in.
I know, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the truth. I know. No, I know. Oh, it's I don't know what's going on, really. I really don't. As I say, I was wondering, did the RSA say we don't need to do it anymore, you know?
Right.
You said, and am I the only person in the country that's noticing this?
Well,
no, you know?
I know one other. My mother is it's one of her pet hates is the lack of indication. But you said you did the test eight times.
I did. Oh, God, I did.
Did you do it all in the one centre? Or did you shop around?
Oh, I did it all in Tralee. Yeah, God, yeah, no, I did it all in Tralee. The divil you know is better than the divil you don't, you know.
Right. So, and how long would you say you spread those eight tests over?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, really. I never thought about that. I never looked at that. I haven't a clue. I don't know. As soon as I failed, I put the thing back in again straight away.
You were back on the horse.
And I tried again and again and again and again, you know.
Right.
So I suppose probably, I don't know, it could have been 2 years or something. I really don't know.
You weren't. You weren't an anxious driver when you were up to keep doing the driving test.
Well, do you know, no. The test, having somebody looking over my shoulder is an anxious point for me. As Nuala O'Fuaillon says, that goes back to national school, because you know, you blot your paper or you write the wrong sum and you're waiting to get the slap on your hand from the ruler from behind, you know. So that wasn't in Dingle, by the way. I didn't grow up down here.
You didn't get a whack of the bottle across the knuckles when you were doing the driving test, did you?
No. But there'd be somebody behind you looking over your shoulder, you know. So it's just made me anxious. That's
and
all. Really.
Do you mind me asking, did you wear the dangly earrings for the eighth time round? Because there was an urban myth that said if you wore prominent earrings, they could
do
see
you know
your
what?
Head
I don't
turns.
Even have a hole in my ear. I never wanted to have one, so I haven't even got a hole. But I'll tell you what happened. You see, it was spilling rain in Tralee for the whole way through the test.
This is the one you
so
passed,
I
is
hardly it? Hardly got out of second gear. I had to go so slow because everyone was bumper to bumper around the town. And I kept looking in the back window just to see that I need to clean it. And I'd clean it and then I'd turn the indicator off straight away because Noel said to me, and when you use that, turn it off straight away because you'll drive people mad in the back. You know, you'd be forgetting to turn it off, you see. And I think your man knew that I was a good driver. Do you know what I mean? I was keeping an eye out the back window all the time, so I didn't need the dangly earrings. No,
so
but I heard about those, all right.
Okay, well, in fairness, for full disclosure, I did four of them myself, so...
Well, there you go.
You
got it. Congratulations.
You did. Eventually, Anne. All right.
You know, look at... I used to work for this woman down here, wonderful woman, Mary Carolyn. You know, she was saying, it was the best day of my life, Anne, when I passed that test. And it nearly is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's up there with the Leaving Cert, definitely, in my case.
And the wedding, yes.
All right, well, we're going to go from roads to the sea after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Joe Duffy! Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. If you read the EPA's report on water quality today, you'll be bamboozled with numbers. 97% of the beaches around the country have water that are of the minimum standard for bathing. There's a terrible trio that don't meet that standard. And Jean Timmins, you swim at one of them.
I do, Colm, indeed. Yes, I swim in Balbriggan. And we're very, very disappointed and devastated by this news for our beautiful beach.
Right. Are you surprised?
No, not a bit surprised. This has been ongoing for 3 years now. We have written to Fingal County Council. We have two swimming groups, the Selkies and the Swimming Socks, and we have both got on to Fingal County Council. The local reps and TDs have got on. And all we're getting really are just standard replies. Nothing is being done and there doesn't seem to be any plan as such to help clean up our river, which is probably the one that's causing all the difficulties. There's different contaminants in the Bracken River, which runs through the town, past the playground, straight into the sea. There's also a broken the pipe misconnection that causes raw sewerage to run straight into the sea. And that, I think all know about that. The council know about that, so hopefully they will do something about that. But you can see the diesel and the oil in the river before it comes into the sea.
And what can you see in the sea? What else is there? I mean, I think we're just past 5 to 3 at this stage. We can safely assume most people have had their lunch, but is there anything floating in the water that would put people off their lunch?
Yes. I won't say what, but there is. It's disgusting, especially after a rainfall. We notice it even more. But it's a lovely resource for Balbriggan. Balbriggan is a growing community. We really need our beach. It's a very popular resort. And it's a shame to see that nothing has been done about this. You know, this oil and the diesel and the dirt that's going into our beautiful sea is very distressing. And it is causing so many of us. It's causing ill health, to be honest with you.
Where's the oil and the diesel coming from? Is it? It's road runoff, is it?
Well, we don't really know where exactly it's coming from. There's definitely dumps. We reckon there's dumps and oil spills. And also, there could be some agricultural runoff there. There's a small amount comes from the harbour, but it's all visible in the river before it comes into the sea.
And why would you keep swimming there?
Because it's a beautiful beach, and because it's something that we do. It's a social event for us, you know, and it's also we meet up as groups for safety reasons. Also, we don't encourage anybody to swim on their own, and also it's for health. And we don't have a swimming pool in Balbriggan, so that is the only place we have to swim. Really, we'd have to go too far to find a swimming pool, and we want to swim in our sea, and we want our sea to be clean. And to be fair, Colin, we give back quite a lot. We have regular beach cleanups, and we have also gotten together to do the Jerusalem line dance, and we raised loads of money for the RNLI. So we give back and we do as much as we can, and we really should have the support from Fingal County Council.
Right, so you're cleaning up the beach. You're cleaning what? Litter and dog waste off the beach, is it?
Yeah. Now, that's another thing. Fingal County Council love to blame the poor dogs for this. Yes, of course, sir. There is some dog fouling, but we're no worse than anybody else. They blame the gulls as well. Now, definitely, we have an unnatural, huge herring gull population. So I would say there is definitely reason to say that they are to blame too. But the poor dogs, we're definitely no worse than anybody else. And because it's such a popular beach, people do clean up after the dogs.
Right, it's not the only beach near Dublin either. If people are saying, well, it's a beach in a big city, this is hardly surprising. I think, as I said at the outset there, 97% of beaches and swimming sites meet the minimum standard according to the Environmental Protection Authority. 79% have excellent water quality, so it's obviously not beyond some beaches to get up to the required standard.
Exactly. It's what's coming in on that river. That is our biggest concern. There's nothing we can do about that. The river is filthy and it is flowing straight into the sea where we swim.
So what can be done about it? Is there any effort further upstream?
We need Fingal County Council to get on board. We need them to talk to us. We will work with them. They will certainly get a lot back from us. So they need to reply to us properly. They need to tell us what their plan is, and they also need to fix that pipe that is causing raw sewage to run into the sea.
All right. The other two beaches are Ladies Bay and Buncrana and Thráth Amán in Spidgel, who have different issues. It says wastewater discharges, runoff from urban and agricultural lands, which would seem to feed into what you're saying there yourself, Jean, as well as dog and other animal fouling, which is presumably what you were talking about there, seagulls and possibly agricultural animals wandering down to the beach. I mean, do you holiday? Do you go to other beaches by comparison? What are you looking at there?
Oh, yeah, I would swim in a lot of different beaches around Ireland. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Our beach is dirty. But what I see when I go down to our beach is a beautiful beach. We have the harbour, the lighthouse, the Martello Tower, beautiful sand, a lovely green bank for people to sit on. It is a very welcoming beach.
Okay.
It is there for families. And why is it not available as a resource for the town? It's a very, very big, growing international community now.
Well, that's That's the point at which we have to leave it, and a good question to end on. The series producer was Annette Egan today. A.B. Philbin Bowman was on research. Liam Mullen was on sound. I'm Colm O'Mungone, and Ray Darcy's next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.